Okay, good morning. We're going to pick up where we left off last week. And we left off last week at the end of the shiur, at the beginning of the Haggadah, which is Halach Ma'anya. And we pointed out that Halach Ma'anya, the bread of affliction, has two aspects to it. One is that it is the poor man's bread. And by Yachatz, we mentioned that we break the matzah, and ordinarily that's understood to be a sign of the brokenness of the avdus, of the slavery of Egypt. But we mentioned that Rav Soloveitchik's interpretation, symbolism of the breaking of the matzah, which is not so much about the brokenness of the slavery of the avdus, but rather a very beautiful idea, which is that in Mitzrayim there were, as I said last week, there were house slaves and plantation slaves. So the Levium, were like the house slaves. There were different strata of slaves in Egypt. And there are those who had more, there are those who had less. And those who had more had to share with those who had less. And the breaking of the matzah is a symbol of the fact that one had to share with the other. When you break bread, the expression breaking bread, it means that you're sharing with one another. So the breaking of the matzah could equally be a thought, a symbol of the people sharing with one another, the chesed, towards one another. And that's a very beautiful thought. So bringing it back to the beginning of the Seder, this is the question we left off with. We said that the Rambam says that generally on Yontif, if you want to fulfill your mitzvah of Simchas Yom Tov, of joy on Yontif, you're supposed to do all types of things. One of the things you do is have a good meal. But unless you make sure to share that meal with somebody else, you make sure to share the material sustenance that we have on Yontif, then our food that we eat on Yontif is simply Simchas Kreso, just the joy of the belly, rather than a more noble spiritual joy, and that comes from actually sharing. So that's generally the case of Yontif. But apparently, when it comes to Pesach, it's even more so. It sort of defines the matzah, right? The matzah that we have, this lechemoni, this is the bread of affliction, but it's also the bread that they shared in Egypt. And in fact, when we start off the Seder, we say this is the bread of affliction that our forefathers called Dichven Yesev Yechel. Whoever wants to come, eat, come and eat. So we start off the Seder with this notion of the importance of matzah and the importance really of sharing with others. Now, as I said, that is something which is relevant to all of the holidays according to the Rambam's definition of the simcha on the holidays. But what is it? What's special about Pesach? And that's that makes it such a core defining element of it. It defines the matzah, it defines the experience of Pesach, of Seder night, and it also defines actually the Karban Pesach itself. The Karban Pesach has to be eaten. Really, you have a bechabura. Everyone joins in. Everybody joins into a group of people that are going to be associated with this particular Karban Pesach. Nobody eats a whole, a whole animal by themselves, right? So everybody joins in. So there's this whole notion of, sharing, of being together. What is, we don't have that by Shavuos, really. We don't have that really by Sukkos. I mean, we have the family sitting in a sukkah, but there isn't a notion of, getting everybody into a sukkah together. So, a person can do the mitzvah of sukkah just by themselves. You go out to the store, you buy one of these pop-up sukkahs, you can stop off on Route 95 and have your sukkah all by yourself. But Pesach seems to be that there's something more specific, something more defining about this notion of sharing, about this notion of togetherness, about this notion of chesed to one another. So what is unique, or why is it special to Pesach more than the other holidays? So that's where we're going to start our discussion this morning, and where we will hopefully end up as well. I want to just recommend a very nice Haggadah. Well, this is one Haggadah, right? Okay, this is the Goldberg Haggadah, which is a great Haggadah if you just want the Haggadah and a nice golden red cover. But this is another nice Haggadah, which also has a nice cover. And this is call The Night That Unites, the Passover Haggadah, teaching stories and questions. And it is put together by, you know, the ideas are written and edited, if not his own. These are by Rabbi Aaron Goldscheider, who's actually a friend of mine. And it's a very, very nice Haggadah that has beautiful, exactly what it says, teaching stories and questions from Rabbi Cook Soloveitchik and Rabbi Shlomo Kalbach. And I think it's a worthwhile read. They're nice little snippets. Some of them are a little bit more in-depth. Some of them are a little bit lighter. But they're all really inspirational, I think, on one level or another. So there's no kickback on this. I'm just recommending it, that it's worthwhile to buy. So at the beginning, one of the beginning stories in his Haggadah, he points out there's a story said regarding Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, who was known as the great defender of Klal Yisrael. And apparently one Erev Pesach, they were going to Leil Pesach before he started the Seder, he told his congregants, not starting the Seder until you get me 50 silk scarves and some Turkish tobacco or something like that. And one other thing, I want a pound of chametz. So his loyal subjects went around town trying to find the tobacco, trying to find the silk scarves. Those were all considered contraband. You couldn't just buy them. This was imported from Russia on the one side and Turkey on the other. And, you know, had to pay customs on these things. You can't just, you know, find these things so easily. After a couple of hours search, they came back and they said, "Dear Rabbi, we have found you the silk scarves. We have found the tobacco, but we can't find the chametz." So the Reb Levi Yitzchak looks up to heaven and he says, "Rabbona shel olam, how great Mika Amcha Yisrael! Look at how wonderful your Bnei Yisrael is. The Russian Tsar has, you know, soldiers lined up on the border to make sure that nothing gets through on this side. There are customs officials and you can be thrown in jail for bringing in contraband from the other side. But all you have is your word. Lo sochlu chametz, don't eat chametz. And while we can find plenty of contraband in town, we can't even find a morsel of chametz." This is how the great affection that the Jewish people have for the mitzvah of Pesach, the mitzvah of chametz, the mitzvah of matzah. So along those lines, we will sort of jump into our topic. Okay, so what is so significant about Pesach that it has this quality apparently of sharing and chesed, etc.? So let's start with a more fundamental question. Why do we lean on Pesach? Why do we lean on Pesach? Fundamental question. It's not really a trick question. It's just to get the discussion going. All right, leaning is a sign of chayrus. Leaning is a sign of chayrus. It's a sign of freedom, a sign of leisure, you know, be a person of leisure and luxury, right? All well and good. The Ravya famously teaches that in today's day and age, people who are free men or women don't eat that way. You know, you have to go to a specialty restaurant to find couches where people eat lying down on a couch. Nevertheless, that's our tradition, and that's our and the halacha indeed follows the more standard approach, which is we do lean. But the Ravya famously says, and it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, many people, especially in his day and age, women did not lean at the Seder. And he suggested that the reason that women didn't lean is because of the fact that they must be relying on this halachic position of the Ravya, that leaning is no longer a sign of freedom, it's no longer a sign of luxury, and people don't eat that way at their tables, right? In fact, if you eat that way at the table, you know, your mother says, "Sit up straight," right? So why do we lean? What's the notion of leaning? So there is, and how do we refer to leaning in Hebrew again? Haseba. Right, haseba. So we find this in Manishtana. The Manishtana, we have four questions. Shebechol halelos anu ochlin ben yoshvin uvein mesubin. We eat sitting or mesubin. Tonight we eat only Mesubin. There is one other place that we can easily find the word Mesubin or a conjugation of that in the Haggadah. And that is, anybody remember where? What? Yeah, Jake? It's actually pretty early on.
They talk about the story of the Yetziat Mitzrayim, no? Didn't they say
they were leaning in Mitzrayim?
No.
Early on in the Seder, Ma'aseh Rabbi Eliezer.
We're talking about the...
Right, the Seder in Bnei Brak,
yes.
where they were talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim all night long. That's what you were referring to.
Yes.
Okay, so right, so we have the word Mesubin there. Ma'aseh Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, show you Mesubin be Bnei Brak, that they were Mesubin, they were leaning in Bnei Brak. That's a strange thing to say. Why does it say Shahayu Mesubin that they were leaning in Bnei Brak? Maybe it should have said Shahayu. You know, soadin b'Bnei Brak. They were eating in B'nai Brak. Shahayu misaprim yitzimitzrayim b'Bnei Brak. Shahayu nohagim haseder b'Bnei Brak. But that's a strange kind of language. What is it? Shahayu mesubin b'Bnei Brak. That they were leaning in B'nai Brak. And in fact, there is a little bit of a halachic problem here. The halacha states that one is not supposed to lean at a Seder if they are in the presence of somebody who they owe great respect to. For example, a student, a Talmud, at the Seder of his Rebbe. It is considered uncouth, it is considered a little bit brazen and chutzpah for a person to sit there leaning back, right, in front of his Rebbe. So, or a child in front of, in the presence of his parent. So there are answers to this, why it's okay for a child in front of his parent and a student, if he asks permission from his Rebbe, okay, all well and good. But there's a notion here that leaning at the Seder is certainly, in a certain sense, a sign of brazenness, of chutzpah, to sit that way in front of somebody in front of whom you owe you owe respect. You know, you owe a certain amount of respect. And here we have in the Seder in Bnei Brak, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Shahayu Mesubin b'Bnei Brak, that they were Mesubin, if you want to take it literally, that they were leaning, if you assume that that's what it means, that they were leaning in Bnei Brak, that they were engaging in the midst of Heseba. So some of these were the students, and some of these were the teachers. So it would seem to be somewhat problematic if we understand that it would be halachically problematic, or at least halachically challenging, for a student to be doing heseba in the presence of the Rebbe. So I'd like to try to come to another definition of what heseba is, and it doesn't mean leaning. So we've done two things so far. We've raised the basic question about chesed, about getting together, and about all of that on why it's significant to matzah, sharing, and Seder night. And now we want to get to now I've raised the question of what is haseba. Right. So
circling.
What?
Circling.
Circling. Okay.
Why?
Yeah.
Because it comes from soviv, and also it would mean that that's how people got together. We go together in a circle.
Good. All right. We're gonna get back to that. So now we're gonna raise one more question, and these are not separate questions. They're actually related. We'll tie them in together. Again, let's go to a basic question in the Haggadah. Why do we have four cups of Haggadah in the Seder? Why do we have four cups? What are they symbolic of? Right, the cups are symbolic of the four statements of redemption in the Torah: v'hotzesi, v'yitzalti, v'ga'alti, v'lakachti. Right, those are the four statements of redemption that God will take the people out of Egypt. So that is one explanation as to why we have the four cups. Right, but there is actually another explanation I mentioned earlier this week, based on the Yerushalmi. Open up your Chumashim to Perek Mem, chapter 40 in Bereishis. Chapter 40 in Bereishis, the end of Vayeshev. Okay. And the end of chapter 40 in in Bereshis, the end of Ayeshev, we have the story of Yosef and the Sar HaMashkim, and the Sar HaOfim for that matter, the butler and the baker. So the Pasuk says, the beginning, what? This in the art scroll, here, why don't you take this?
I'm not using the art scroll.
What page is it in that one?
And what page is it, John?
149. 149 in the Hertz, right? In the art scroll, Chumash.
Where in the story do you want to begin?
We're going to start from chapter 40. Let's see here. About
16.
Okay. So we're going to start from Pasuk 6. Start from Pasuk 6. Vayavo aleihem Yosef baboker. Yosef came to them in the morning. Vayarosam v'hinam zoafim. And he saw them, and they were aggrieved. They were upset. Vayishalas risei paro asher yitoba mishmar beis adonov lemor. Madua pneichem ra'im hayom. He said, why do you guys look so bad today? Vayomer elav. And the butler and the baker responded to him, Chalom chalamnu ufoser ein oso. We had a bad dream and nobody to give us a good interpretation. We needed a good Freudian psychologist, and it was pre-Freud, so they were stuck. Vayomer aleihem Yosef, and Yosef says, you don't need a Freudian psychologist. Rather, haloli lokim pisronim sapruna li. Hashem has all the interpretations that you need. Tell me, and let's see if I can help you out. Vayisaper sar hamashkim is chalom ol Yosef. And the butler, the chief cupbearer, tells his story to Yosef. And Yosef, Yomer lo, and he says, b'chalomi v'hine gefen lefanai, I see a grape branch before me. Uva gefen shlosha sarigim, and on this vine there are three little branches sticking out, or three tendrils. Vehi kifarachas al sanitza hivshilo ashkeloseha anavim, and its blossoms bloomed and its clusters ripened into grapes. Okay, he's got a grape vine in front of him. Bekos paro biadi, and the cup of paro was in my hand. The Yerushalmi says that the first cup of the Seder night is referencing this cup right here. Kos paro biadi, the cup of paro was in my hand, says the butler. Vaykaches ha'anavim v'eschato samel kos paro. And I took these grapes and I pressed them into wine, into the kos paro, to the cup of paro. The second cup of Seder night references this second kos right here in the story of Yosef and the Sar HaMashkim. Vayatenes hakos al kaf paro. And I took that cup and I put it into the hands of Paro. The third cup of Seder night is this third cup of Yosef and the Sar HaMashkim and Paro. Ba'ot shloshes yamim, Yosef then responds and he says, in another 3 days, Yisafaros roshacha, Paro will restore your head, or will lift your head, Ve'heshivcha al kanecha, and he will restore you to your post. Benasata kos paro viado, and you will put the cup of paro in his hand. Kemishpat harishon asher yisa mashkehu. This is the fourth kos. All right. So we have here something very interesting. Very, very interesting here. The Yerushalmi says, and by the way, there's a fifth kos. Take a look at Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Vayeshev esar hamashkim al mashkehu, and Vayeshev, excuse me, esar hamashkim al mashkehu. Indeed, Yosef's interpretation came true, and the cup and the esar hamashkim was restored to his position. Vayitain hakos al kaf paro, and the cup was placed in the hand of Paro. Okay, so the Yerushalmi says that the Dalet Kosos do not reflect, or not in. Necessarily the Dalel Lashonos of Geula, that's maybe one way of looking at it, but another way to look at it, says the Yerushalmi, is that the four cups of the night reflect these four cups of Yosef, the dream, and the with the Sarah Mashkim and Paro. So what does that mean? I get the symbolism of Hotzesi, V'Hitzalti, V'Ga'alti, V'Lakachti, four statements of redemption. That makes sense. We're at the Seder. We're going to be redeemed, or we're reliving redemption. We drink these four cups to commemorate the four statements of redemption of old and our faith and our emunah and bitachon that we will be redeemed once again from this, from this kalos. All well and good. But if you say that the four cups relate to these cups in the dream of the Sarah Mashkim, why is that at all relevant to Pesach night? Why is that at all relevant to the Seder?
Well, he is a prisoner and he does get freed.
Okay, he's a prisoner and he gets freed. All right. Well, so is it just a coincidence that it says the word kos four times there? I mean, we have other prisoners in Tanakh or other people that are under dire situations. Not the only person, but I would agree to you to your point that it does make sense that he is a prisoner who is freed. So okay, but I think it's more than just that, because the Dalet Kosos reflect here. It says the word kos four times, and maybe even a fifth time, maybe to reflect the fifth kos. So I think it's more than just there's a guy who was in prison who was freed, because there are other people in Tanakh that were also imprisoned. Daniel and the Gova Rayot, he was saved, right? So it seems to be a connection here, not just about somebody being freed. Yeah.
It's always coupled as a phrase. It's kos paro. It's not kos. It's kos paro.
Okay.
Good.
I think that furthers the fact that there is a deep connection here. We still have to explain what that connection is, but you're right. It says kos, paro. He puts it into the cup of paro, the kos paro. So there seems to be an allusion here to the cup of to paro. Now it's not the same paro. Ultimately, all those years later. But even Vayaka Melech Hadash, even if you just at that point a new king arose who did not know Yosef, right? But what Marjorie's saying and what Chaim is saying is furthering this point that there seems to be a deep connection here between the Leil Seder, Yitzias Mitzrayim, and the story here of Yosef, Paro, and the Sarah Mashkim. So what is that? What is that that deeper connection?
Yosef.
What? Okay.
Yosef. It's not just the two aspects of coming in and getting out. It's his whole the whole story of him coming and being in Mitzrayim and being a slave and then being and his body being released beforehand. So his body had a geula, and we wouldn't even be in Mitzrayim if it wouldn't be for Yosef, because his forefathers who tried to get into, who went to Mitzrayim, they came back to Canaan. But because of Yosef, you have everyone coming into Mitzrayim and eventually having the geula.
Okay, so Morty takes it even further, right? So we have what Marjorie said, that Yosef was in prison, he was released. Chaim, we have Kos Paro, seems to be a closer allusion. Morty takes it even a step further, that the only reason that the Jews are in Egypt altogether is because, Yosef went down. In fact, Abraham, had an opportunity to go to Egypt and he came back. So the fact that Yosef went down, Yosef is really the reason that they're down in Egypt. That they're down in Egypt altogether. So I think that that even furthers the connection. Okay, want to take it even a step further than that. Listen, I didn't photocopy this for you, but just listen to a few lines here of the Tashbits, and this is from the. Haggadah. I recommended Rabbi Goldschreiter's Haggadah earlier. I want to recommend this Haggadah as well, the Torah's Chaim Haggadah. It has a wonderful commentary. written very clearly, even sometimes footnoted for additional clarification, written in nice block Hebrew, and wonderful classical commentaries of the Rishonim. So one of the Rishonim whose parish is included here is the Tashbetz, or Shimon Bar Yitzchak Tzemach Duran. Right? So the Tashbetz, one of the Rishonim, the Tashbetz says the following. When do we say, what is the answer to the question of Manishtana? What's the question? What's the answer to the question of Manishtana? Why is this night different from all the nights we spoke about last week? How is this night different? What has changed? But simply, we ask the question of Manishtana, what's the answer in the Haggadah? When is the answer provided? The answer is provided in Avadim Hayinu. So, you know, really, we could just... Why do we have the rest of the Haggadah afterwards? So, we really could stop the Haggadah just at the beginning. Yeah. What Manishtana, and we give the answer. Avadim Hayinu Lafaro b'Mitzrayim. And we have we've done the Higadat Alevincha. We have fulfilled the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim of telling over why we're here. So that would be what I call the super, not just the cliff notes, that would be the digested cliff notes. Okay?
Right.
So.
Well, we can't do it because we have to have time in between all the kosos.
What? Yeah, we can't do it because we need a little time between the kosos. Okay. So the Tashbetz says the following. What is the answer to the tshuva to the question of Manishtana? Tashbet says, Avadim hayinu l'paro b'mitzrayim. The answer is, we were slaves to Paro in Egypt. The Amar Rabbo Seinu Zal, and our rabbis taught, Shehu poseach bignus, that the structure of the Seder, as we've pointed out in the past, is that it starts off on a low note and ends on a high note. V'hagnus hu, so what is the gnus here? What is the, Avadim hayinu l'paro b'mitzrayim, we were slaves in Egypt. And what is, and you know, within 6 seconds, we say, Vayotzienu Hashem Elokeinu Misham Biad Chazakov Zroa Netuya. That God took us out from Egypt. So we start on a low note and we end on a high note. I mean, we go right into that high note pretty quickly. So maybe that's what it means. Maybe it means we start on a low note, the first sentence, and we end on a high note, the second sentence, and that's the end of our cliff note Seder. Right? That's the whole Seder right there. Now maybe it is. But he suggests the following. He says, what is the low note? So, pshat, what's the low note of the Jewish people in the Seder? In the, you know, the story of the recounting. What's the low note? What? Avarim hayinu. So the Tashbetz says, no, that's not the low note. We're just in the middle of a story. Avadim hayinu is not the beginning of the story. Avadim hayinu is the middle of the story. What's the beginning of the story? It says, Masha Amru B'Medrash, Atem Mechartem Yosef Le'eved, you sold Yosef, you the brothers, you B'nai Yisrael, sold Yosef down to Egypt, La'avod, you sold him to be an Eved, Chayechem, I vow to you, says the Medrash in God's voice, Chayechem, B'chol Shana Tikru'u Avadim Hayinu Lefaro. I vow to you that every year you will recite the statement, we were slaves in Egypt. The Hashevach, and what's the praise, what's the glory, what's the high note of the Seder? Hu kimo she Yosef mi beis ha'atzurim yatza limloch gam anachnu yatzanu l'cheiros. Just like Yosef came out and he ultimately assumed the throne in Egypt, you too will be freed from your exile. V'chein ya'aseh limos ha-mashiach, and so will be done during to the time of Mashiach. Now, so the Medrash is saying, the Tashbetz is applying it here. What's the low note of the Seder? Not Avadim Hayinu. Avadim Hayinu is the middle of the story. The end of the story is that we are going to be freed. It will be Mashiach Zeit, right? We're going to be freed. We will have a redemption, just like Yosef was redeemed. The middle of the story is that we were slaves in Egypt, just like we are in some element of Galus now, right? And the beginning of the story, the gnos, middle of the story is not the gnos. The beginning of the story is the gnos. Because taking what Morty said and put it on steroids, we are in Egypt because of Yosef, but not really because of Yosef. We are in Egypt because of what brothers did to Yosef. The brothers sold Yosef down to Mitzrayim. Right? Now, however you want to apologize, defend it, explain it, Yad Hashem, da-da-da-da-da-da, the brothers had Bechira Chafshis. The brothers had freedom of choice, and they chose to do something which was not great. They chose to do something based on kinah, based on jealousy. The pasuk says, "Vayikane bo'achav." The brothers were jealous of Yosef, these dreams of grandeur. So the story of Egypt begins with the brothers selling Yosef and committing that crime against Yosef by selling him down to Mitzrayim. That's where the story begins. So if that's where the story begins, if that's what the low point is, so what is the essential cause for Pesach? What is the essential cause for us being in Mitzrayim? Yeah.
Jealousy.
Jealousy, disunity, sinas chinam in the most classical example. Right? I heard this idea first put forward by Rabbi Jacob Schachter many years ago. The cause of Mitzrayim is really Sechinam. Now you might remember, it says in the Shulchan Aruch that if you don't have a good memory and you're always trying to plan ahead, so you know that there are certain days of the year that correspond to other days of the year. So the first night of Pesach always corresponds with Tisha B'Av. So if Pesach is on a Monday night and you're planning your summer vacation, then you know that Tisha B'Av is also going to be on a Monday night. You don't even have to look at the calendar. Mm. What's the connection here between Pesach and Tisha B'Av? Did it work out? How does it work out? Ronnie, how does it work out this year? Pesach, first night of Pesach is Friday night. Tisha B'Av is Shabbos, and it's a Nidchet to Sunday. Okay, what? All right, so I didn't check the calendar, but that's what's got to be. Tisha B'Av's got to be Shabbos, and then we'll push it off to Sunday. So what's the And in fact, there's a minhag to have an egg at the Seder, and one of the explanations for having an egg at the Seder, aside from for the Karban Chagiga, having an egg at the Seder. Why an egg per se? Because an egg is a symbol of Avelus. And the first night of Pesach, corresponds to Tisha B'Av. All right. So, what is it? What's the connection between Tisha B'Av and Pesach from the perspective that we're taking it?
Avadim Hayino, you're saying is a low point, and also being in Mitzrayim. When they were in Mitzrayim, there is a sheet that says that because Yosef wasn't able to give the brothers a full zman of slicha, that the Churban Beis HaMikdash was the final cause to that. So then we can say the real low point would be the Churban Beis HaMikdash, which we can...
The Churban Beis HaMikdash.
Right. And what is going to be the high point? The high point will be not just the Geula from Mitzrayim, but the Geula from the Mashiach, Jehovah Yemeno.
Amen. Okay. All right. So we're putting you up on the pulpit next Shabbos this morning. All right. So the question, the connection here is, what do we all know about Churban Beis HaMikdash? The destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was caused by Sinas Chinam. By Sinas Chinam. Even the first Beis HaMikdash, we commemorate plenty of other things, including Sinas Chinam, right? The divisions within Klal Yisrael. Right? The day after Rosh Hashanah, we commemorate Tzom Gedalia, which was when Gedalia was assassinated by another Jew. Right? So Bein Bayis Rishon, Bein Bayis Sheni, the cause, the essential cause, is Sinas Chinam. So we have a connection here from Pesach to Tisha B'Av. Pesach is to Sinas Chinam, because if Sinas Chinam is the cause of exile, the cause of going down to Mitzrayim, the cause of Galus, then the redemption, the Pesach, the Geula, will be a consequence of what? Of fixing Sinas Chinam, which is, you know, Ahavas Chinam, loving one another, sharing with one another, Chesed to one another, being together with one another, unified, right? So all those things are what will bring about the Geula. What's the famous story that the Gemara in Gittin says about what helped to bring about the Chorban? The story of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. What's the story of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza? They both were invited to a
simcha, a meal.
To a feast, to a meal. They were invited to a meal. Well, one was mistakenly invited instead of the other. So Tisha B'Av, right? The Chorban is the Gemara in Gittin says was caused because one guy was invited to a meal mistakenly, and the other guy, then he was embarrassed and they threw him out and nobody said anything. So there you have a meal, right? People being disinvited. Right? What's Pesach? Pesach is a meal, and everybody is being invited. Kol dichvin yaseh v'yechol, kol dichvin yaseh v'yifsach. Right? Pesach is the opposite of Tisha B'Av. Sinas chinam, avas chinam. Yosef being sold down to Mitzrayim. And whose bones are taken out sworn to be taken out of Mitzrayim?
Yosef.
So we have all these connections to Yosef because of the fact that Pesach is the story of Yosef. It's the story of the brothers who sold Yosef down to Mitzrayim. And Pesach is the Geula, Pesach is the redemption, which is a redemption of not just slavery in Egypt, it's a redemption of the causes of that slavery, which is which are the brothers in selling them down to Egypt. Now, if you look at the Seder from this perspective, you can see a bunch of other things as well here. So, Morty, we said about Manishtana. What about why was Manishtana significant? So, what is Manishtana? There are two ways to learn. One is through what we're doing primarily now, which is I get to stand here and talk a lot. The other way is through dialogue, right? The Haggadah is established in the form of dialogue. That is talking to one another, right? The Rav Kook, again, from Rabbi Goldscheider's Haggadah here, Rav Kook points out that it says, Talmidei Chachamim Marim Shalom Ba'olam. Talmidei Chachamim bring peace to the world. How they bring peace to the world? Talmidei Chachamim are arguing all the time. I hold this way, you hold that way. The Gemara is all about arguments. What do you mean bringing peace? It's machlokas. It's the exact opposite of peace. Rav Kook says no. True peace comes from the ability to hear someone else's opinion, even if we don't agree with it, and to be able to value it from where it comes. So if you think about it, that's true shalom. That's true peace. Honoring the other. That's a path to geula. We start the Seder with Manishtana. Manishtana is exactly that. And we have, questions. Start with questions. To be able to learn from another. Like I said last time, who's the sofer and who's the sefer? Who's the scribe and who is being inscribed? Who's learning and who's teaching? Right? So if we're all learning and teaching from one another, that itself is an exercise in bringing the Geula, in undoing the Yosef story. Furthermore, as I pointed out last time, we have the four sons, right? The Dalad, the four sons, the Dalad Banim. Now, I get three of them, the Chacham, the Tam, the Eino Yodea Lishol. All of them make sense. But what about the Rasha? Why are we including the Rasha in the Haggadah? And the answer is, I think, for this very same reason. That by listening to the challenge of the Rasha, there's something to learn there also. There's value. There's value to hearing something even from the quote-unquote Rasha. I mean, what does the Rasha say really at the end? Well, he doesn't say anything so terrible. We call him a Russia because he excludes himself. You know, okay, all well and good. But he says something. He's making a point. And that point needs to be valued, needs to be honored. And we honor it in the Haggadah. How do we treat the Russia? So everybody sort of remembers half of that. The af ata hakeyat shinav, which means that you should clock him in the teeth, right? That's the simple read of that. But it can't really mean that you should clock him in the teeth, that you should punch him in the mouth. Because it says, ve'em or lo, and then explain to him, bavor ze asa Hashem li b'tzisi Mitzrayim, v'lo lo, ilo haya Hashem lo haya nigal. You give him an answer. The fact of the matter is that even the Russia has a point. And we have to sit at the Seder and listen to him. You can't run away. That's true shalom. That is true geula. To be forced to sit and listen to somebody who you don't agree with. We call him a Russia. And the liturgy of the Haggadah forces us to address his point. Not just to walk away from him. That is not an easy thing to do. Right? A lot of times you hear things that people say. You don't want to hear it. You walk out. Turn away. Ignore it. Right? People don't like what somebody says. A speech. You walk out. Walk out of a speech. But the point of the matter is that tonight is an exercise in geula. In bringing about geula. When we say that tonight you have to consider yourself as though you were in Mitzrayim and as though you came out, you're supposed to sort of reenact and relive Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's not just about pretending that we're going out. This is an exercise in what to do in order to bring about Geula. We're forced to listen to the Russia. So Manishtana is part of that structure. Being forced to listen to the children, and especially the Russia, is part of that. The students in Bnei Brak, right? The Seder in Bnei Brak. So again, who's listening, and who's teaching? Who's the student, and who's the teacher? Right? We pointed out last week about the story of Ben Zoma, right? That Ben Zoma was the junior to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Right? So who's the junior and who's the senior? When you have to listen to somebody who maybe you think that you have what to teach them, but maybe now I'm forced to listen to them and they have what to teach me. Right? That is the path to Geula. Now, in that story of the Seder in Bnei Brak, we have Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. I want to tell you something interesting about Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Maybe you know it, maybe you don't. So, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was Harani Kiven Shivim Shana. He was like 70 years old. And we all know the story. How was he like 70 years old? That there was a big machlokas. They wanted to fire the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, and they wanted to install somebody else. So they figured out half the job. They figured out how they figured out how to give the pink slip to Rabbi Gamliel, but they didn't figure out exactly who was going to replace him. So they went to Rabbi Yehoshua, went to this, that. Ultimately, they settled on Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the Gemara says, and was asked, what should he do, if he would like the job? We have an opening. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah did what any good married man would do in such a situation. He said, I have to ask my wife. So he went over to his, went home to his wife, and his wife said to him, what are you, nuts? They just canned this guy. They're going to can you tomorrow. What are you going into? This is a lose-lose situation. So, like any good husband, what did he do? He took the job. Right? So he said to his wife, listen, if you can, the metaphor that he uses is, if you can hold the golden cup, the golden scepter, for one day, isn't it worth it? So in other words, that this is a unique opportunity, something very valuable and special. Even if he'll only have it for a short time, it's worth it. So he assumed the position. Guess what happened? A day later, or within the same day, they decided to rehire Rabban Gamliel. Right? The Gemara says that on that day they decided to rehire Rabban Gamliel. Apparently Rabban Gamliel did a little tshuva, and he realized that maybe he was a little bit too, you know, tough, or his policies could use some rethinking. So he did tshuva. So they were ready to rehire him. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah just got the job, right? They just replaced the plaque outside the door, right? When I used to work in private industry, so a fellow told me that he worked for AT&T or some major corporation, and the CEO of the company was the most powerful man, and he was somewhat of a micromanager, and everybody was in fear of him. The guy died. God, unfortunately, he died. He died in office. He said within 24 hours there was a new plaque on that door, CEO of the company, and somebody else was in there. Ki'ilu lo haya velo nivra. The guy, so totally replaceable. But here, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, lahavdil, didn't die. He was standing right there. So what was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to do? So they worked out a deal. It was going to be 75-25. Every 3 weeks, one of them would be the, would give the drasha on Shabbos. And one out of the 3 weeks, the other one would. And if I recall correctly, Rabbi Gamliel gave it three times. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah did it once. So for every 4 weeks, Rabbi Gamliel, who had just been fired, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah had been hired in his place, did it three out of the 4 weeks. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah gave the drasha on the fourth of those 4 weeks. The story of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Hare Ani Kiven Shivim Shana, is really the story about, if you think how the story ends, it's a model of reconciliation. Right? Number one, Rabbi Gamliel, saw perhaps the error of his ways, if you can call it that. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was very gracious. He allowed him back, in fact, gave him the lion's share. And they shared the throne, as it were, of running the Sanhedrin. That's an unbelievable thing. Right? If you were fired from your job and your good friend, or just your colleague at work, got the job instead of you. Right? Let's say the opposite. Either way. There's sort of bad blood. It's one thing that they fired me. You're going to take my job now? We've been working together for the last 20 years, and we've been teaching in the same school. We've been working at the same company. We've been hand in hand. Now you're going to stab me in the back? You're going to take my position? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, it's back to the way it was. We're going to compromise, we're going to share, reconcile. The story of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is not just about Hare Ani Kiven Shivim Shana, I was 70 years old, and now I know how to say Yetzias Mitzrayim. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is a story of reconciliation. That is the story of the Seder. That is the story of Geula. The Seder is an exercise in how to go from exile to redemption. The fact of the matter is, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, in fact, in his short term in office, he instituted some interesting new policies. So, for example, he opened up the Beis Medrash doors to pretty much anybody who wanted. Beforehand, they were a little bit more of elitist, and now anybody who was so interested and desiring of studying was given entry. So he sort of leveled the playing field. That's, if you think about it, maybe there's a value to an elitist philosophy, but an elitist philosophy does separate people from one another. And his approach, right or wrong, the added value that it does have, or the characteristic that it does have, which can't be argued, is that it melts people together, brings people from different levels together. It's not elitist. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is all about reconciliation, unity, bringing it together. So, furthermore, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the Gemara says, is the one who said that a Beis Din, you know, in order for a person to be killed by a Jewish court to get receive capital punishment, they have to go through lots of hoops. They can't mete out capital punishment so easily. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said that a Beis Din, a Sanhedrin, that metes out capital punishment once in 70 years, that is, that's a terrible Beis Din. That's a killer Beis Din, right? That's a killer Sanhedrin. That's a killer court. So, in other words, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is the one who, again, this reflects a whole notion of, you know, of the opposite of killing, of the opposite of death, of the opposite of harshness, of the opposite of division, of the opposite of toughness, of the opposite of all those things. So we get back to, you know, Rav Kook said about shalom. What brings shalom? What brings true peace? Peace is when a person can sit, when people can sit and listen to each other and hear other opinions and still value the other person from where they're coming from. That's Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is the model of reconciliation. Okay. So having said that, let's go back to some of our original questions. We'll do 3, 2, 1 in reverse order. Number 3, we asked about the cups of Paro. What is this Yerushalmi talking about? And I think the answer becomes clear that the reason that we're connected to the cups of Paro is because what caused, you know, Paro of Avdus, of slavery, the cups of Paro, right? In other words, the story of Yosef coming down to Mitzrayim, it all comes from, you know, Yosef. It's the reason that we're in Mitzrayim is because of Yosef and what happened to Yosef, which is about disunity, about sinas chinam, and about all of that. So that, I think, explains why this allusion to the four cups, to the four cups of Yosef and Paro. Second question we asked, what is haseba? What is leaning? So Chaim said, what we all would say, that leaning is a sign of cheros, but it's not. The chiddush here, the newfound idea, is that haseba is what Morty said. Haseba is lahasev, which means to circle. Now, in a circle, who's in front and who's in back? The answer is nobody. In a circle, everyone is facing each other. Right? How do we refer Jake to a party in Hebrew? What's a party? Misiba. What does misiba mean? A misiba, I think, means a gathering together. Rav Kasher in his Haggadah makes this point. It's a gathering of people. So the haseba is not so much about leaning. Yes, it's about leaning, but it's about something deeper than that. Haseba is about relating to one another, about coming together as one another, right? To circle, to be together, to relate, to come, to unify. That is haseba, which we should do today, whether leaning is, you know, is a reflection of cheres or not. This deeper level of haseba is still entirely relevant. So even though halachically speaking we lean, we, you know, that's what we do, but when we think of haseba, we should be thinking of this deeper level, the haseba of coming together, the haseba of unity. Because as I said before, the seder is an exercise in bringing about redemption. So when we lean, you know, if you don't have a chair, so the halacha is, you know, you lean on your neighbor, right? So I think that too is a metaphor. You know, leaning on your neighbor. We should all be leaning on, you know, on one another, right? If you can't, you know, lean on a pillow, you know, lean on a couch. So you lean on your neighbor. That's also haseba. Haseba from both perspectives, you know, the perspective of leaning and the perspective of, you know, coming together. And then back to our question, the first question that we started with, which is what is so unique about Pesach? That we say that you know, the matzah of Pesach, kol dichven yaseh v'yechol, whoever wants to come and eat. Every holiday is like that. Every holiday you're supposed to do that. The Rambam says that if you don't share, if you don't make sure that your neighbor has food on their holiday, then you're just filling your belly. But every holiday is like that. So what's so unique about Pesach? We have Maos Chitin on Pesach. We have, you know, in preparation for Pesach. And, you know, the matzah called Dich V'nei Yaseh V'yechol. That's how we introduce the Seder. Whoever is hungry, come and eat. That's how we introduce the Seder. Why don't we do that by Sukkah? Whoever is hungry, come and eat. No. Because Pesach, the Seder night, is an exercise in how to bring about redemption. What are we bringing about redemption from? Yosef. Sinas chinam, disunity, machlokas. And this is about bringing together ahavas chinam, chesed, sharing. That's why we break the matzah in yachatz. It's not a matzah, we're broken of avdus, that's one symbolism of it, but it's the matzah of breaking of sharing. That's the essence of matzah. That's the essence of the lechem oni. That's the essence of what we say at the beginning of Halach Ma'anya. That's the essence of the Seder. That's what we do Haseba for. And that's the Dalet Kosos as well. And with that, we'll stop. We should all have a Chag Kosher V'Sameach and do what we can at our Siddurim to help bring about the Geula.
Have a good Yom Tov.